Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Along with me, a worthy adversary across the board, Mr. Tim Dennis. How you doing, Tim?
Hiya. I'm doing good.
Being in the media, as long as we have, we've come across our fair share of crazies. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to pigeonhole anybody here, right? Because we have a lot of fantastic listeners around the world.
Very true.
But sometimes things can get a little scary and a little hairy.
Mm-hmm.
And people listen to you and think they know you. And sometimes they think they know you intimately. And that can be terrifying. And just imagine if you were a beautiful little blonde woman who was in the public eye and on TV and into everybody's home on a daily basis. Tonight, we're going to take a look at when the news becomes the news. On the hunt for Jody, who's in truth. And Tim, now joining us for the remainder of tonight's show, veteran crime reporter Caroline Lowe. She joined the FindJody.com team back in 2011 after leaving her 34-year career at WCCO-TV right here in the Twin Cities to become KSBY-TV Santa Barbara County, California newsroom manager. Lowe returned to her roots, though, as a reporter in 2015 when she did two investigative series on missing persons and unidentified human remains for KSBY. As part of the investigation, Lowe created the most comprehensive database of missing persons on the California Central Coast. And in 2015, she also began working special assignments for Care 11 TV in Minnesota on the Jacob Wetterling abduction case. Lowe has an extensive background covering cold cases. She's filed numerous reports regarding the disappearance of Jody Huzentrout and the abduction of Jacob Wetterling. While at WCCO, her I-Team reports garnered national attention. Her work has appeared on 2020, Oprah, Court TV, and Forensic Files. She's here with us this evening to talk about Jody Huzentrout. Thank you for joining us, Caroline.
Thank you for having me.
All right. This is a case literally close to home. You've got a Minnesota girl who grew up with the determination and idea of becoming a newscaster, to become an anchor person for the news. And this, what an amazing, you know, deal to actually have this idea in mind from being very young and following through and getting to that goal. That just says something about Jody right there.
He was very, very motivated. Her dream was to come up to the Twin Cities. I think that's part of why it's so many of us who got involved in her case feel a connection. We can relate to her. This was somebody who could be what we did. She went through, you know, I didn't start there, but most reporters start in smaller markets. She was doing that, had sent her audition tapes up to the Twin Cities right before she disappeared. In fact, a month after she sent the tape, she disappeared. And I recently talked with a former Channel 11 news director who said that they end up using that same audition tape for the story on Jody. She'd actually called her and talked to her and encouraged her, and then a month later, Jody's gone.
Well, talk to us a little bit about Jody Huzentrout prior to the disappearance. What can you tell us about her besides being a very driven individual?
Well, she was passionate about golf. That was one of her things that she was very good at, and she grew up in Long Prairie, Minnesota. Her father died when she was very young, and she grew up there, and she went to St. Cloud State, was interested in communications, worked initially at a TV station in Minnesota, and then she got hired down in Iowa. And she was there just under 2 years, and she's getting kind of restless to move to a bigger market, and it started sending out her videotapes, hoping to, as I said, come to the Twin Cities someday. Or her other thing she considered is maybe moving to Arizona. She wrote in her journal those last few months that she was getting a little tired of the cold weather. But somewhere, I think if things had not taken the terrible turn that they did, she'd be somebody you would have been watching in the Twin Cities TV or maybe in Arizona.
And here she is, Mason City, Iowa. Did she have a large group of friends there? Had she kind of, you know, aside from just the fan base and people that watched her show, and she became very popular as well. She did morning and afternoons there. Did she have a big
base? Exactly. And people still, they know him. Go ahead.
I said, did she have a big base of actual friends in that area?
From what we can tell, she did. I've talked with a number of people who she became friends with during the time she was there. And plus, she kept up with her friends from high school and college. And in fact, she was going to be going to Minnesota for a wedding, I believe, the next week before she disappeared. So she had a strong core group of gals, people she hung out with that were her support group, in addition to her friends who lived in different parts of the country and back in Minnesota.
Had she, to your knowledge, ever received any kind of death threats or issues at all doing the job that she did?
No, we've asked about that a lot. There was one point when she thought somebody might be stalking her, somebody following her, and she made a report on that, but nothing that to the point that she was overly concerned about anything like that. Just the normal stuff that we deal with being in TV news. Sometimes you'll get phone calls or you'll have a viewer that doesn't like something, but she seems to really thrive in being a part of the community. And the night before she disappeared, the day before she disappeared, she'd been at all day at a golf tournament fundraising event in Mason City, had a great time, met a lot of people.
Now, you said that she had had a concern about a stalker, and she felt maybe she had an obsessive viewer. What do
maybe,
we know about that part of the story?
It didn't sound like it was that big of a deal. I mean, I've seen some over the years where it became more serious, but she thought there might be somebody following her, and she made a report to the police. But beyond that, she didn't seem overly concerned from any of the friends we talked to or her coworkers. In fact, her news director hadn't even been aware of any of that until anything like that till after the fact. So it wasn't to the level of a big concern that I've seen over the years with some of my colleagues.
Has anyone examined that initial report to see what kind of details she put into it as to why she believed that she had an obsessive viewer?
The basic thing we heard, this seemed like somebody was following her. There wasn't a whole lot more than that. And it wasn't an ongoing thing. There was just something where she was uncomfortable. But there was not some steady pattern where they're looking at bringing in extra security we were aware of or that she was aware of.
Now, of course, just before we started speaking with you, Tim and I were talking about the fact that, we love doing the show that we do with Darkness Radio and here with True Crime Tuesday. But that there is this strange connection that you forget about when you're a broadcaster. That you're going into people's homes, and in our case, it's just our voices that are being beamed to these people around the world. And you're open about your life, your personal life, your work life, and forget that you become something much more to some of the viewers than you ever expected. And we've run into that time and time again, where then you go out somewhere in person and you're doing a meet and greet. And somebody's very vexed that you don't recognize them from social media, and then they start getting belligerent or angry with you because they feel like they've had you. Well, we exchanged emails last year, and you're like, right. Well, I get hundreds of those, but there's that it's rare, but it does happen on occasion where you get a very aggressive, obsessive listener or viewer who feels like you owe them something. Is that and I said for Tim and I mean we're two overweight bald guys. Attractive women.
You sound good.
You sound good
on the radio.
Thank you. But, I can't imagine how much more unnerving it has to be a woman in this situation and being on television where you're viewed. And part of, unfortunately, the part of the culture is looking good and having to look good for television. So that kind of puts
you... And being very personal,
right.
Being very... people feel they know you're in their living rooms. And it's worked to our advantage at times. I can't tell you how many times I've knocked on the door of somebody in Minneapolis after terrible crime. And it's a very difficult part of our job to do. But they feel they know you. It's been an icebreaker. So it's worked that way, but it also works the other way. And I think people, if you don't show enough interest or you can... who knows? And that's one of the things we won't know until this case is solved. Is the fact that she was on TV, was there somebody obsessed with her who was actually the person who abducted her, or was it somebody she knew, or we just don't know. But that's certainly a scenario that makes it different than maybe some other crimes because of that part of the celebrity part, the feeling that they know you and they know your patterns. It wouldn't be that difficult to figure out Jody's pattern during the morning news. If somebody were to be stalking her, they're going to know what time she has to be at work by, at least within a ballpark. So I think it makes her potentially more vulnerable to that kind of a criminal.
Here's something, kind of taking us off task just a bit, Caroline. I'm curious when we hear these stories that are breaking, where some of these girls that have gone missing 10, 12, 15, 20 years ago are now being found and found alive. And, that's, of course, the hopes is that maybe Jody is somewhere and she's still alive and there's still that chance, that possibility that she's just in somebody's care. And I use that term very loosely, but that she's still there. Do you think, though, that when people are being found like they have been, do you think that that's put kind of a death knell onto the people that may be in that situation now that they realize, oh, people are being found, mistakes are being made. I better not keep myself, you know, open to this any longer. And do you think that that in some of these cases,
it's certainly where we a possibility? Found them, right? And I think in Jody's case, I don't. Sadly, I don't think her family, I mean, they had her declared legally dead in 2001. I don't think they feel much hope there. But I'll say, on the other hand, having covered the Wetterling, Jacob Wetterling case, the boy was abducted in Minnesota and missing for 27 years. Patty Wetterling believed till her child's remains were found that he might be coming home. She never changed her phone number. They never moved because until Danny Heinrich led authorities to his remains and his clothing, she held on to that hope. Because she's also, through her work around the country, seen that that's happened. Knowing that the odds were against it, she held on to that hope all those years, and so did the rest of the family, but particularly Patty, never let go of that.
Okay, talk to me about the morning of June 27th, 1995. What can you tell us about that day? Was it any different than any other day? You said the day before she had been at a golf tournament. What else do we know leading up to that day?
Well, I'll go back a couple days. The weekend before, she disappeared on early in a Tuesday morning. The weekend before, she'd been water skiing with friends, and according to her journal and the friends I've talked to, she had a great time. She was skiing with a couple of gal friends and also a person who had hosted the birthday party for a surprise party a couple of weeks earlier, John Van Sice, whose name recently came up in connection with the search warrant that was filed last year. No accounts of any concerns, had a great time. And then on Monday, she did the morning news, her early news, 6, and then she left around 9 to go golfing, part of a 4-person team in Mason City. And so she spent the day golfing. Part of it was rained out, but hung out there, went home around 3 or 3:30, changed her clothes, got cleaned up, went back, and had a great evening from the people I talked to who sat at her table, who visited with her. Had a dinner, and then she left around 8 and said goodbye to her news director who was there and said, I'll see you in the morning. The next we know of what happened is 4 o'clock in the morning, she had not shown up for work. She's supposed to be at work about 3. Her producer, Amy Coons, called her, and Jody was clearly asleep. She had overslept and didn't show any concern. She asked what time it was, said, I'm on my way in, you know, I'll get ready. She never showed up. Her newscast was at 6. Amy tried again to reach her, didn't hear from her. What we believe happened from different things in the parking lot is that she was probably grabbed around 4:30, 4:45 in the morning. There are reports of a scream, not confirmed, but some neighbors said they thought they heard a scream that was never reported. At 7 o'clock, her station, when someone from her station called the police department just to do a health and welfare check because she hadn't shown up. When they show up in the parking lot, they find her red Miata, a Mazda Miata out in front. The door is open, keys bent there, and some of her personal belongings are strung in the parking lot. Clearly signs of a struggle, and that's it.
All right, now you've got this.
She hasn't been heard since.
Right, you've got this timeline. Now, a lot of people have talked about the fact that it must be somebody that knew her and knew her schedule, but yet we just said, right, she usually was up by 3 and out. But here it is, you know, 4:30, she's getting a call from her producer. Oh, yeah, I overslept. Sorry, what time is it? I'll get right in. And now this, according to the producer, too, was not unnatural for
Jody.
It had
happened before.
Right. It had happened before. Not showing up.
Not enough to call the police right away and think something was going on. Exactly.
It was just I overslept, little mistakes like that had been made along the way.
Right.
All right. So that's why, and I think that's an important part of the story to share so that people understand why the producer was not a little bit more alarmed by this. Because Amy even came out and said that there were times she had rolled in late as well. And this was just, you know, it's a smaller market and everybody knew each other and would cover for one another. So it wasn't out of line, although it was unusual. No, it wasn't out of line for this to happen.
It wasn't out of line. And at that point, Amy was just trying to get the news on the air. She had to not only produce it, she had to go out and be the talent, be the anchor on it. So she's just trying to get the show on the air. And, but, you know, I think nothing jumped out other than Jody didn't show up at all. But at 7 is when they end up making a call and they see these unusual things, clear signs that something was wrong. When they went in her apartment.
Well, now, can I ask one thing about that real quickly before we get into the apartment? So no other neighbors happen to notice that her Miata is sitting there with the door open and that there's shoes and items strung across the driveway?
No, but nobody noticed. Nobody called.
And, you know, as an investigative reporter yourself, doesn't that seem kind of out of place?
It does, but I've also done this enough years that, you know, you would think that people would call if they hear something, or I've been at things where there have been stabbings and people didn't call it in or didn't hear anything, but it does seem unusual. And again, we don't know what went down.
All right, now we go into the apartment, and what time is this that the police gain entrance?
It's at this point, it's probably close to 7:30. Just moving ahead, yeah, probably around 7:30 they go in, and they went and had the apartment building manager let them in, and nothing looks out of the ordinary. The only thing that's sort of stayed with them over the years and trying to figure out what it means is the toilet seat was up. Now, is that a sign that, one, either it was Jody perhaps sick, did she have a male guest, or did a police officer who didn't think it was that serious of a thing at the time use the facility? We, the bathroom, just don't know. But it was one of those things that I have on my list of,
Well, that is an interesting aspect of the case, and I didn't realize that part. And you're right, it's sad, but police officers have often made those kind of mistakes. I mean, we covered that on the Bob Crane murder a few weeks ago, how cops were walking around smoking and touching things and letting people into the apartment or hotel room, rather, where Bob Crane had been murdered, and allowed his son to just go in the refrigerator and take some stuff and leave. And, you know,
I think prior to OJ, there was even more of that before the OJ Simpson. I think things my observation gotten a lot better in terms of the integrity of crime scenes and collection of evidence and how you secure a scene and what you do. But certainly, you know, we're talking almost 23 years ago, and I don't think they really thought they had a crime on their hands at that point.
So they find her car open, her key bent, items strewn across the parking lot leading away from her car, and at this point they're not sure they have a crime?
But they have now. Well, even when they first reported, there were things described as kind of unusual, but I know some people thought maybe she just took off. You know, people do that. And I've covered enough people who have just taken off when you think, oh, they wouldn't have done that.
Well, taking off, and again, please, Caroline, I know this isn't you, and I don't mean to sound irritated at you about it, but it's just... Okay, you take off. Usually it's a clean leave, right? You've got your stuff, you leave. Leave a couple of shoes and then your hairdresser down further and your key bent and your car door open. You close shop, you know? Okay,
unless you're going to leave. Trying to throw people off, unless I've seen things be done that when there was a deliberate attempt to throw people off.
Well, let's talk about that then.
Most people just take off.
Right. If there's a possibility that Jody, who's in truth, decided to go on the lam for some reason, if we take a look at that aspect of the story, is there any indications as to why? Was she having men problems? Was she having work problems, a drug problem, alcohol issues, anything that would lead us to even, you know, think
Nothing.
For a moment?
No. No. And I've talked with a number of her close friends. And I think one of the significant things we saw, I don't know if you're familiar with her journal that was the former police chief's wife mailed to the local newspaper several years ago. And they didn't know initially who it was from. Then they found out that the chief had said he inadvertently brought it home, had a copy of Jody's journal, and the paper published it. And there was no science in that. None of the things. It was more her frustration of wanting to be in a bigger market, that sort of thing, but nothing. No signs of fear. None of the things that I would be looking for, frankly, as a reporter and as a woman, of some kind of clue.
And no reference
and nothing
to
from her friends that I talked to.
She had these friends. She had a regular friendship reportedly with this John Van Sice. Were there any indicators in the diary now that you can look at that there was any issues on the horizon with any of the people in her life? Did she ever, had a weird night tonight? Caroline and I got into a fight at the bar. I mean, was there ever anything in the notes that might even indicate that?
Not in the stuff that was released. If there was something there, I have not seen the original. There was nothing that was there. And I talked with a gal that was with her water skiing that weekend, and she said Jody seemed fine. There was nothing, no fear, no signs of concern. The people who were golfing with her at her table on Monday said she stayed all day and she seemed to have a very good time. There was no indication of anything going on.
So why have they only released portions of the diaries?
Well, the newspaper received it, and I don't know if they had some kind of an agreement with the police department, if there's something that they thought could be harmful to the investigation, but they released what they did several years ago, and it's considered evidence, so we don't get to see it. But it just so happened that the police chief's former chief's wife had mailed one to the newspaper where she had worked several years earlier.
Why didn't she?
And we don't know what was that about. We have no idea what would prompt somebody to mail something like that to a newsroom.
To a newsroom and not to the police. Why wouldn't she just have it?
Well, the police already had it. The police, this is a copy of what the police had in the evidence room.
Oh, got you. Okay. All right.
That her husband had brought home when she supposedly inadvertently, when he retired, he brought some things home and she came across this diary journal.
All right, let's go down the rabbit hole and then we'll come back to the story. If that's a case, then was there ever any investigation into the police chief, the retired police chief? And, you know, what was the reasoning for him keeping this? And the only reason I ask this again is because it does seem strange that she would send this off, the wife would send this off at a later date to news agency. And do this. Was there any chance?
Anything I could say would just be speculative. Like, why would, other than I've seen people hold on to files, I've seen people, investigators I know, bring things when they leave. This was probably the highest profile case that he ever had in his history. So maybe it was just pieces of what he was holding on to. But, you know, you're not supposed to take evidence. And what was her motive? And she was never available to the media. Initially, it wasn't clear who sent it in, but the subsequent investigation led to that. There was never any kind of charge or anything like that. But I just thought it was, if I read it, I've read it and reread it and look for any little something that might tell us something. And I don't see anything there. And then you'd see from any other young man in a smaller market hoping to move to a bigger market. And
all right. And this retired police officer, are they still with us? Have they passed on? Are they still around?
No, they moved to another state. They're not in the area.
Okay. All right. Sorry. I just, as these things pop up again, you ask questions and who knows, if we have a listener out there, something might pop and you put them on a different direction. Mm-hmm. That's what we're hoping. All right. So let's start to look into this. Now there has to be a general form of suspects that the law is initially going to go after. Can you introduce us to some of the people on that list that they would start investigating immediately?
There's nobody that they will say that they've ever considered a serious person of interest. A couple news media organizations have talked to them. They've indicated that John Van Sice, who said he was the last person to see her, was certainly somebody they questioned. He has said that he took a polygraph and passed. We've never heard that from the police, and they don't normally confirm those things one way or the other, but he said that he was the last person to see her. He claims that when she, after the day of the golfing, that she went over to his place, also in Mason City, another place, and looked at a videotape of the surprise party.
All right. He claims.
We don't have anybody that confirms. He says he was the last one to see her, and he was pretty open with the media in those first few days and said how much Jody meant to him. He had named his boat after her, had this surprise birthday party. Clearly, he has some very strong feelings for Jody.
Right, but now this is kind of
20 years older than she is.
This is kind of getting ahead of the story, right? I mean, if you're somebody that would be a person of interest and you're relatively intelligent, you would kind of want to put yourself in the crosshairs at first so you could easily be dismissed and come off as the caring friend. He makes a claim of taking a lie detector test. There's no verification from the police, although many reports out there and some of the different investigative TV shows claim that there is information that he did take that and passed it. But there's no, and I understand the police won't necessarily comment, you know, on whether it was passed or not, but why wouldn't they? Why wouldn't they just take that off the docket? Why wouldn't they say, yes, he did take that, we're not going to release what the response is, or something along those lines?
The basic answer we get is they don't discuss investigative techniques. You know, they won't go there. But I wouldn't say it's all that unusual for people to sometimes want to be associated with somebody. He was associated with her as a celebrity when she was alive. In those first few days, it's not all that unusual for somebody to say, yeah, I really knew this person, or this was my neighbor, or whatever. So I don't think that in itself necessarily is implicates somebody. But he certainly got on their radar early on.
All right. So John Van Sice, her friend, 20 years her senior, throws this surprise birthday party for 4 days before her disappearance.
It was actually a few weeks before.
Oh, it was. Yeah, okay.
About 2.5 weeks.
The night before.
He had a water skiing party the weekend before. That was different from the birthday party.
Okay. The night before, he invites her over to reportedly look at these videos of the surprise birthday party. Then he admits to, you know, I cared about her. I even named my boat after her.
Right.
Doesn't that seem weird? When I've seen that interview, it always seems like, why did you bring that aspect of it up? And then did they ever, mm-hmm. was there ever an investigation of his boat to look for any kind of evidence?
Yes. Again, they won't be specific, but we've heard that they've spent a lot of time focusing on any property, anything connected with him in those days and weeks and to probably to this day.
All right. And where the boat was docked. I know that a lot of the bodies of water immediately around the area were investigated. Did they ever look at where his boat was currently docked? And in that
they were, I believe they were in that area. I know they went to a number of places and I believe they've looked at that. They've looked at, I'm sure they looked at vehicles that are assigned to him back then as well.
Right. And that's part of kind of the update in the newer story. We'll get into that a little bit later as this continues to roll out. All right.
Well, those vehicles are actually more recent ones, and we can get into that later. These weren't sure. vehicles that would have been around back in 95.
Okay. All right, great. We'll cover that in a bit here then. Mm-hmm. So we've now he's tried to throw himself out there saying, hey, look, this is the case. And, mm-hmm. I'm clear at this point. And we do know for a fact, right? I mean, lie detectors are fallible. That's why they're not always very very well used by the police
officers.
They are
not generally admissible in courts
right.
that I've been around, but I know that law enforcement use them often as a way to figure out which direction to go in. Sometimes it says, okay, this gives us an idea. I've known of, I was talking with somebody this past year who worked on a case, he said, with a serial killer where person passed the lie detector test. So they're not infallible, but they are used as an instrument for investigating. Officers use it when they get hired. They use them for background checks. So
right.
they are used, but they're not 100% and certainly not admissible in court.
Okay. So there's one of our biggest suspect possibilities is John, because he does mm-hmm. have access to her the last night. Wade Wagner
right.
Was a former broadcaster that she worked with, correct? And he was even called and very loosely interviewed and I guess quickly dismissed as well.
A lot of anybody who worked with her. In fact, I talked to people who were in the newsroom back then. They said they all kind of felt like they were kind of suspects. Everybody's looked at because
right.
anybody, most of the time when people are murdered or disappeared, it's connected to somebody they know. It's
right.
usually not a stranger. So you've got to go down that path. That's why like Jacob Wetterling's case, again, his father went through a lot. You have to eliminate the people closest to begin with. That they generally, it's someone with a relationship that's going to be involved in a homicide.
And Amy Coons even says in the interviews that she's done that they all even started side-eyeing each other at the news
yes.
station, right? And that's got to be a weird environment
exactly.
to suddenly you start looking at the people around you thinking, did you have,
Sure.
And when you look
that
at something.
Combined with the fear for themselves.
Right.
Wondering, is this person's out looking for more than just Jody? Is this somebody who's targeting all of us or a woman on TV or what? Because you don't know. In the absence of answers, you're just going to come up with horrible scenarios.
Right. And then the prospect that who did it and who would have access and thinking that this person had to have some kind of knowledge of her and her time. And in
right.
that case, would know that maybe she was running late and past her normal scheduled time to be out there. Because, we're talking a couple hours past when she should have already been on the road.
True. And someone also, if they were stalking her, could be sitting in that parking lot and I've talked to people who were there back time. You could actually see into her apartment. You could see a light on. You could see somebody getting dressed. So even if you were running late, if you had a stalker or somebody else mm-hmm. who, was targeted other than a Van Sice, a stranger who or someone else who knew her, they could wait long enough and wait it out and see what's going on.
I know one of the other stories that popped up, one of the other newscasters, anchors, had heard from a Captain Kidnap, I guess, was posting on some social media site or some website and talked about, plans for a future kidnapping. What do you know about that aspect of the story?
I don't know much about that. I've heard that over the years, and I've heard of other ones, and they've taken off lives of their own. It's just like any time we hear a body, we go running, we think it's Jody. We
right.
did for a long time, just as in Jacob. There's just so many of those. You mentioned rabbit holes. There's so many of those things, and until they're eliminated, track them down, because who knows? We don't know what happened to her, and I think it could still be somebody she doesn't know. I don't think that can be ruled
right.
out. We learned from Jacob Wetterling that they were focusing on somebody for many years and search warrants and right up until about a year before they found Jacob thought it was somebody else.
Now, I don't know the area very well.
Person.
How far is Mason City from the Twin Cities?
It's about 2 hours.
All right.
2 hours south of the Twin Cities.
So 2 hours south of the Twin Cities. Were there other kidnappings prior to that that would kind of follow a pattern, sexual assaults, anything of the nature that would lead us to think maybe there was a serial perpetrator in the area?
Not a serial killer. There was a couple of years later, I ended up covering a rapist up in the Twin Cities who raped a couple four women in 2 weeks. And when the police started doing background checks on them, they discovered that he was living in Mason City at the time Jody was there. So we were contacted by them. They contacted Mason City and shared it with them. And then we did some digging at WCCO, and we found out not only was this person living in the Twins in Mason City back then, he was 2 blocks from Jody's station. He had a girlfriend that looked similar to Jody. There are a lot of things that said you have somebody who's capable of this kind of violence, who was living in this small town of 28,000 people. Take a look at him. And I have no idea if he had anything to do with it. He's denied it over the years. I've talked to him on the phone, and when he's in custody, the police don't consider him a suspect, but he certainly was somebody you had to look at. Could there be somebody else that we don't know that she had a friendship with?
Right.
Now, this other person who's been obsessing with her.
This gentleman, you were a gentleman. I use the term loosely again, especially with having gone to jail for rape and attacks. Tony Jackson, he was also, was he quoted as saying something while in custody, or was it just the rap lyrics that he had written? That
it's the rap, but we don't know. We have somebody who is in custody, a cellmate, who claims that he said some things about Jody being stiffened in Tiffin, the town of Tiffin, Iowa. And he went to the guy, went to law enforcement, brought that information. In fact, our WCCOI team brought in some cadaver dogs and law enforcement from around the country that went and searched a farm that kind of fit the description down there back in 98. Nothing came out. The dogs alerted them some stuff. They did some tests and nothing came of it.
Let me ask real quickly.
When
you say, okay, so Stiffin Around Tiffin is part of this rap lyric
Tiffin
that he wrote and supposedly quoted to this guy in kind of bragging. Maybe he knew something about Who's in Truth's vanishing. What brought your group to that specific farm? What about it made that a point of interest?
In terms of that particular area, the actual farm or what part?
Right. I mean, in many of the accounts that I've read and watched on the different shows about this, all there is he does this reference to Stiffin Around Tiffin, but I never got
Stiffin in a pile of a silo. It was just some different description that kind of said there might be something that would fit. And we talked to some people down there in local law enforcement. It's not the same jurisdictions where Jody disappeared from. And there was an abandoned farm, and that's why we thought, well, come in and take a look. And as I said, in the end, it did not produce anything.
Okay, so you were going off other clues from that
rap. We don't know if that
rap
was made up. We have no idea.
Right.
Could have just been jailhouse, you know, trying to get some leverage out of it. We just don't know.
But now you had 3 cadaver dogs. Is that what I understand that went to that farm?
Right.
2 of the cadaver dogs marked a positive for
alerted.
Right. For human remains.
Yikes.
And the third dog did not notice or did not alert at all.
Correct.
So when they alert,
but that can also be blood. That could be somebody could have, you know, had blood in the thing that had nothing to do with anything. If I had a bloody nose, sometimes certain things like that can give things off. But the dog handlers felt that it was a sign of human remains from their training experience. And they were from, the one was from Kansas, Texas, and one other place. They thought there was a sign that something had been there at some point.
Something meaning a body, possibly, or
like human remains of some
okay.
some smell of death. They're trained to detect that. And but as they took some boards, some items, they sent to the state crime lab, DCI, and they didn't come back with anything. Some reports said it was animal blood. They didn't come back with anything conclusive.
Interesting, because most cadaver dogs are specifically trained to alert on human decomposition, not just of blood, but of bone and organs, right?
Right.
They know the difference between animals
that the handlers had back then. So, could something else have happened and been moved? We don't know. But in the end, the test, you know, is another. We had a lot of hope, frankly. You know, as crazy as it sounds, a rap frying and all that, but who knows? And life. It just went nowhere.
Well, I guess in the silver linings of this, at least we didn't find a dumping ground similar to the Weepy Voice Killer, right? Where all of a sudden we are out looking for one person and we start finding body after body after body. Now, they did find in one of the investigations a body that they thought might be her remains, but it turned out to be a man that also went missing in 1995.
And there have been others, just like Jacob. We had one where I'll never forget. They found a child's body in the Mississippi River, and it, and everybody thought it fit the description of Jacob. Age turned out to be a little boy that had been who had been his body had been grabbed from a cemetery in Minnesota.
Was there ever any evidence left at the site except for, you know, just her items that had been dropped? I heard mention of a palm print. Was there anything to that?
There's a palm print that's never been identified.
And where was that located? On her car?
That was on the car. And but, you know, that also could be somebody who walked by and looked at her shiny new. She only had it a few weeks and touched it. And it's not conclusive, but if you ever had somebody in custody and then there was a match, it would be huge.
Do they even do palm prints, Caroline? I mean, I've heard of fingerprints, but do they?
Yeah, they do. They still do. You know, they're very, and things, one of the things you potentially have too is if anything was left, they have trace DNA and things nowadays that we didn't have before. And if there could have been any little something in that potentially on the car, and again, I don't know what they have. They don't share it. But if there's something, if some cells were shed, if you will, they can get DNA off them now.
Was there any indication of wound, blood, anything? I mean, it seems like if we're to believe she was abducted, she had been dragged across the parking lot, either to a waiting vehicle or over onto the other side of the park. Was there ever any blood, hair,
never,
anything?
We've heard reports of blood, but never heard of that substantiated at all. Not at all. So, I mean, a better thing is she may well have been knocked out, just grabbed and taken away, but no reports.
Caroline, why after this many years are the police not more forthcoming in order to help try to, you know, get this case moving again?
What they have told us over the years is they feel that if information gets out, it's not going to be helpful to solving it. And, you know, and that's kind of a mixed bag. I found over the years that some investigators at certain points in cases feel like, what do we have to lose? Maybe there's something we throw out there that might stimulate interest or might mean something to somebody. But as long as I've covered it, and it's been 20-something years, they have never shared very much information.
And there were over 1,000 leads that were called in.
Oh, tons. Yeah, I don't know what the final numbers were, but they're still getting calls. They're still, I mean, we get calls at our findjody.com website that we pass on or we talk to people, and those things are still coming in. And anytime you have another story, a big story like the one that we did on Friday, that tends to bring people out of the woodwork, some with a lot of not so great ideas, but it also tells people that maybe they have something that they haven't called in before. I talked with a guy last year who had noticed some things a little bit different in the parking lot that he never reported. And I said, you know, if you don't know how significant something may be, please share that information.
Now, the vehicle that people claim they saw was either like what, a white or light tan or cream colored van that had been in that parking lot at some point?
We've heard that, but I'll tell you, I mean, do you know how many white vans have been associated with almost every big crime I've
exactly.
ever covered?
Exactly. Right.
You know, that could be a utility van. It could be people hear that. I would probably say I'd caution against putting too much in that.
Isn't it about time we just outlaw white utility vans with no windows? I don't mean that smugly,
yeah,
but yeah, I mean, that would help limit and eliminate a lot of things.
I've rarely seen them turn out to be the vehicle that was involved in something.
Right. All right. Now, I know some of the other, and as we're just kind of looking and stepping over some of these points, that's why I'm asking insights on this. There, you know, was some mention of drug issues in and around Mason City, and that she had maybe been working on a story. Are there any indications that there's any legitimacy to that, and that maybe she had just pissed off the wrong people by getting ready to do a report?
No, I've talked extensively with Doug Murbach, who was her news director back then. I've talked with her friends. Those weren't the kind of stories she was interested in. She liked doing people stories, lifestyle stories. That is not likely something she ever would have been assigned, from what I was told. So I don't think there's truth. I do believe there was certainly drug activity going on there. And one of the things that came out about a year after Jody disappeared, they arrested a gal and a guy for a drug-related death. Five people were killed, Dustin Honkin. But Jody was not investigating that. She was not part of that. There's nothing, and there's no indication she used drugs. There's nothing that pointed to anything from anything I've heard, other than that's a common thing I often heard in Mason City when I was first investigating this.
I'm sure this is something that's got to drive them crazy as well. In Mason City, I don't know how large of a community it is, but I mean, is this crime still on the forefront for them as a regular basis, or only as a new lead pops for them?
They say that they work on it all the time, but I think, and it's a town of about 28,000. The reality is, you know, you get new, someone said the expression, fresh death. You get new cases,
right,
and you work on something when something comes in and you poke around, and then there's the ups, you know, the roller coaster ride, and then you go back to doing what you're doing. If something significant came through, I can't imagine they wouldn't be all over it. And they also have the state DCI, which is like Minnesota's BCA, the FBI. I mean, they have a lot of law enforcement tools and willing to help. And I've talked with a number of investigators, retired investigators that we've dealt with on Find Jody. I think a lot of people would be willing to do whatever they could. It's a case that strikes close. It's part of the fabric of Mason City, and I think people need to have answers.
Where do you stand, Caroline, on the idea of profilers? It seems that there's been some pretty big flaws shown in the whole profiling department of looking for perpetrators like this. Do you have any faith that we can give a pretty solid idea of who does a crime like this or why?
I think, again, it's a tool. I would be careful not to get locked into it. I've read a lot of, assume you read some of John Douglas's books,
right,
and there's some interesting things in there. But and I know in the Heinrich case, it turned out much of what he described that did, he worked on the case, did fit Danny Heinrich from Jacob's case, but I don't put a lot in there. I read them and I try to get in the minds of killers. I get a lot more out of reading interviews, or I think I mentioned before, I interviewed Paul Stefani in prison. I try to get to know these people, real people who committed real crimes, and kind of try to get whatever insight you can, and maybe it'll help you with the next one.
The case too, when you're looking at something like this and you've got, such a tragic figure, right? I mean, you've got somebody who had so much left to live and she just vanishes out of the air and there's no trace. That just seems nearly impossible to me. Did she have cell phone, anything that...
didn't have that. She didn't carry one. I mean, few people had them, but if this happened today, we'd have so much more tools. I think she could have called right away, or there'd be follow-ups. We didn't have those things back then. And as I'm talking to you, I'm staring at a picture of it. I sit here in my office here in California, and I think, what am I missing? I'm going back again tomorrow, going through the old clippings. Is there something in there that's just been overlooked? Because we've seen with these cases, again, with Jacob, when they took another look after the 25th anniversary of Jacob Wetterling's abduction, they went back and it was going back in the files and rereading a report from one of the other victims' mothers describing something that prompted them to go and test the shirt of Jared Shirell. And there was a DNA, they were able to get DNA that led to Danny Heinrich. Well, is there something there that hasn't been tested that maybe will pop? Is there something, somebody who hasn't been interviewed, or some ex-girlfriend who's been keeping something who hasn't been reached, who needs to know that the case is still out there? That's why we keep going at Find Jody. We know that we're a tool that people can reach all over the world. And if somebody has a relationship with somebody or had a relationship, that they're just Googling Jody Huizentrout, maybe they'll come into the site and realize that this case is still unsolved. And maybe they have information that they haven't shared and will come forward.
And please do check out the website, findjody.com. You can find a lot of this case and all the information and line up the information, all the people involved in helping to solve this case. Were there calls from people reporting to be the abductor?
Not that I've heard of over the years, no, which, I mean, it's possible, but nothing that's ever been shared with us.
All right.
Again, in Jacob's case, there were a lot of false leads. People who thought they were Jacob saw Jacob. Not a lot of that with Jody.
No, she just vanished without a trace. There was no, I mean, a few That's people right. said she showed up supposedly in Alaska, right, on a news station or something.
But she's never heard anything that even seemed like, oh, this is really it. Where, again, with Jacob, there were some leads over the year, but not with Jody. There have been remains found. Anytime you hear of something found in Iowa, Kansas, Minnesota, I mean, my antenna goes way up. And then I want to know, you know, when did it happen? And it goes up and then goes down the roller coaster.
Were there, back in 95, were there reporting agencies for sexual predators so you knew, you know, who was in that area and at what time? Because like you said, I mean, it was quite a while later that Tony Jackson popped up and suddenly you realize, oh, he was within blocks.
He wouldn't have been on the radar because he hadn't committed criminal sexual conduct cases then. This stuff happened after he left. So
my point was in that fact, I mean, here's one that came back and you're able to locate that they were right in that area. Was there ever any kind of locating service for that? I know that takes place now. I don't know when that officially began, but
It started somewhat around after Jacob disappeared in a few years before Jody. In fact, Jody actually covered Jacob's disappearance. I don't know if you saw that in your research.
But yes.
Actually interviewed Patty Wetterling at one point. That's so eerie. But one of the things they ran into with Jacob's case when he disappeared in 89 was that there wasn't the reporting. So Patty Wetterling and her efforts and others got things so became a lot better, but there was not a lot of that back then.
Okay. And I'm sure that they've gone through quite a bit of information trying to, check out every possible angle on who could have been, you know, in and around that area. Do you follow threads into other states, neighboring states, Wisconsin, Minnesota, you know, or going down to see if there's any other strange disappearances, any other strange things that would kind of follow into that same suit that we could look at as a serial perpetrator? And I don't say
there's
serial
not
killer.
One that's doing this kind of victim, though, which
okay.
is different with Jody is because she's on TV. That's unusual. That's what makes her. At least it seems to be. I mean, the other possibility is could it be somebody who was in the parking lot, who whatever reason was at the place and grabbed her? I mean, that's certainly a possibility.
When we talked about the weepy voice killer, right? If they have a red shirt and you find him dead, I did it. It could have been that he had no clue this was Jody who's intruded. He just grabbed a cute blonde that was early, available, and nobody else was around, right? It was a crime of availability as opposed to a crime of obsession or possession and needing to take that celebrity.
Absolutely. And could it be the thing where somebody grabbed her, did not realize she was a celebrity, and then holy heck, becomes a really big deal and better get rid of her. That's a possibility.
It's got to be maddening too.
I wouldn't rule out anything. Pardon?
I said, it's got to be somewhat maddening because I guess, you know, in saying, okay, if we start looking to profile, are there other people, you know, I guess if I said at any point, redhead with fair skin went missing here, can we find any other stories within 100-mile radius of redheads with fair skin going missing? And you might be able to find that has absolutely no ties to this one case.
Right.
It just, you know, you get the population
so
big enough.
What it has in common may be irrelevant.
It's just
the coincidence. And you asked me about other people they looked at, some other well-known killers in the area. One guy who was convicted several years later, Donald Blum, was looked at. He was, I don't know if you remember him, from Katie Poyer. He was convicted several years later.
Right.
He was looked at to see where he was. And so anytime you had anybody associated with some big crimes, there's another one, Tom Corskaden, who was in southern Minnesota, who had said some things that people thought sounded strange. He was looked at. There have been a number of others like that who have been looked at and eliminated over the years.
When you say he said something strange, do you know what the specifics were of that? Or again,
well, there was some interpretation. Some people felt he implied that he had something, or sometimes if you talk about the case, and I don't know all the specifics, but there were things that got him on law enforcement's radar. But I've been told since then that they were able to, and sometimes now with ATM stuff, there are things you can say absolutely not possible. We put this person in such and such spot. And in Donald Blum's case, because he'd been known as he was convicted of criminal sexual conduct with some women in the Twin Cities, he was convicted of a woman in Moose Lake. They thought, well, could he have been in that area? And he supposedly had traveled through Mason City in the past. I had a call just a few months ago from somebody who thought somebody she knew was suspicious and been down there and might have been down there the weekend before, and to make a long story short, the dates were off. Wasn't doable. You know, it was absolutely not. But just we hear from people like that, and you get this kind of like, wow, could this be it?
All right. I left an important pause there so that my producer can go back and edit this out if it's something you don't want to answer or you feel may cause an issue for the investigation. Do you know if people do call into a tip line, how anonymous is it really? If I were to call in to the findjody.com tip line and say, I did it. Here's where you'll find the body. Is it truly anonymous? Can that person finally give up that information so at least we can bring Jody home? Or is that...
We'd have to have a very serious discussion about what to do. I mean, we would do everything we could to be responsible about that. And that would be a tough one with it. Because, you can't protect somebody totally.
Right. I understand that. But there are things like, we mentioned earlier in our dumb crime segment, they're like people, they're looking for this. If you have any information, you can call anonymously to Crime Stoppers or this tip line. I'm just curious if are those truly anonymous? So if we can shake the tree.
I was actually involved with Crime Stoppers up in San Luis Obispo even before I moved up to the San Francisco Bay Area. And I went to the regular luncheons and they conveyed that they were pretty, and it's made up of law enforcement volunteers, and they said they were pretty careful to be very protective of their, that was a huge part of what they felt was creating confidence for people to come forward. Now, the other side of it, one of the big battles going on, if you've been following the Wetterlings file efforts to keep their files protected. Have you been following that in the Twin Cities?
I have not, no, not recently on
well,
that case.
Well, Patty Wetterling, because the case is closed, all of the investigative files are going to be released. There's just thousands and thousands of pages. And the Wetterling family is fighting to keep some of it. They consider it very private. It's not relevant that they don't want to release. But during, as this thing is playing out in the courts right now, one of the things that's come up is a lot of people called in neighbors. They called in other people, never imagining that someday that it could all be public. And it's all going to be on the internet when they release the files. That is a concern. You want people to feel confident, but if they know that maybe it might come out, that could be a deterrent.
Right.
And there's some efforts to potentially changing the law in Minnesota on that because of the concern that, suppose you think your neighbor's been acting a little strange and you call it in, and then someday that report could show up on the internet.
For listeners, and, it's believed in some of these cases, the perpetrators will follow different leads and different shows talking about this case to see if they're getting close, if they're getting any information. We'll throw out for that person, if you are listening to this show, or if, whether you're the perpetrator or know this perpetrator and you want to at least come forward with the information on where we can find Jody, just reach out to the tip line, find an anonymous way to get the email to them, something to give them a positive direction. And, it'd be great if you just turned yourself in and make life a lot easier, but at least do the right thing so that Jody's family can get some kind of closure on this case, some kind of answer.
Her family needs it, and the community needs it. We all need it. And there are ways you can do that, to do the right thing. There are ways you can get information out there, and I would hope that if there's somebody who has a conscience, who's been holding on to something, don't make her family wait another year. Her 50th birthday is June 5th. It'll be the 23rd anniversary on June 27th. Don't put this family through another year of not knowing. They just want to be able to do some kind of burial. Her mother begged me years ago to please stay on it because she wanted to be able to bury Jody before she died. Well, her mom died a few years ago, and I just feel this real sadness that I was not able in a small way to make that happen. So if you know something, do it. Do the right thing. Share that information. Point us law enforcement in the right direction. Whatever you do, just come forward.
Come forward with at least the basic information of where she is, right? We understand you're not going to turn yourself in most likely, but if you feel that point of at least let somebody know where that is, maybe that will give you some form of absolution wherever we end up, in this lifetime. But give that back to the family. That's the least you can do, is if you've got that information, just let them know where Jody is so Jody can come home. And she has family members that are still alive that need answers. There's a community that's been so deeply wounded. There are people out there. And if this was a one-off case, let other people go to bed and sleep well, knowing that they're not in some invisible crosshairs themselves. It's just... do the right thing. And that's all we can ask in this kind of case. It's so heartbreaking to hear a case like this that 23 years later, and it's a high profile person. It's a high profile case that we're still no further along 23 years later, really, than we were at the time of the abduction is Terrifying.
And all it takes is one call, somebody, as you said, to do the right thing. And I'll tell you, I'm in a community now where a little girl named Polly Klass was taken a few years after Jacob. And it was a horrific thing in the community, but she was found a couple months later. And as horrible as it was what happened to her, at least they know. They're not right. looking for somebody else, wondering for that about that phone call, or is she going to walk in the door? And give the family the peace, give the community the peace of knowing what happened. Don't put the other people through it who've been looked at, who may have nothing to do with it. Just do the right thing.
Do the right thing, and feel free to reach out. Email dave@darknessradio.com if you're afraid, and I'll just pass the basic information on and keep your email hidden and quiet, but that way they get the information, we can get the answers, and try to help out. So that's an option for you as well. There are some new updates in the case. Can you talk to us a little bit about this and what's going on currently?
Well, the most recent update was a few weeks ago through somebody who came to our site and was doing some digging, went online to Iowa Courts Online, which is a public online service in Iowa, and found that John Van Sice, whom I mentioned, we mentioned earlier, had two vehicles associated with him. We don't know if he owns it. We don't know what the connection is, but his name was listed online in connection with a sealed search warrant indicating that the Mason City Police a year ago on March 20th executed a search warrant seeking GPS data on a 1999 Honda Civic and a 2013 GMC. And we don't know what they got. We don't know why they were looking for it. He lives in Arizona now. We don't know if he came back to visit. We don't know if they're maybe looking at him, following him, whatever it all means. But they had to, authorities, law enforcement, had to make a case to a judge to convince them that it was important enough, had reasonable probable cause to think that it was connected to the Jody crime, that whatever they were seeking and why it was important. So a judge signed the warrant, and this warrant was sealed for 6 months. And then last fall, after 6 months, it was sealed for a year. The county attorney tells me they'll probably continue to keep it sealed until somebody is charged, the case is resolved. If they had found something, there probably would have been another warrant. If it led them to search some site, that would have led to something. So we don't know that they found anything because there was not a subsequent warrant listed. But something intrigued them, interested in them a year ago in connection with two vehicles and John Van Sice.
Which was going to bring me into my next point. Has there been any other mysterious disappearances of people in John Van Sice's life since that point?
Not that we've heard of. You know, he's had a couple of traffic incidents and things since he left, but there's been no crimes of violence or anything associated that we have heard. And I should also point out on search warrants, I know a lot of the people responding to our reports is there's a lot of local buzz, and I'm grateful that the local media is covering it because we really think it's probably somebody down in that area who knows something. But there were search warrants in Jacob's case on, I mentioned the neighbor, and they were able to convince the judge they had a reason to dig up his property for a couple of days, and turns out he was totally innocent, had nothing to do with it. So they have to make, the law enforcement has to make a case that this is what they believe and why they're doing it, but in the end it does not necessarily mean had anything to do with the case that they're looking at. So kind of keep that in the back of your mind when you hear about various things that are going on.
Caroline, has anybody since the case investigated John Van Sice's work, his residence? You know, aside from doing a preliminary, did they ever go any further with investigate? Did he live in an apartment or was it a house? Do you know?
I believe it was a duplex. I think he went there, but I have not heard anything in recent years. You know, and he was cooperative at first, and he was quite open with the media at first. He doesn't talk anymore. But I'm sure the vehicles were looked at. I know they talked to people who knew him, but I don't know what they've done in subsequent years. And, you know, whether they've gone down to Arizona, you know, they would have to have a search warrant there, though, if they wanted. You can't just, as you know, go into a house. You'd have to make a case why something in that house is important for the crime that you're investigating.
Understood.
I've not heard anything in years. That's why the search warrant jumped out. And this is the first public warrant we have heard about in many, many years of any sort.
The reason I asked is, in some of these cases, we've talked with Sergeant Paul Dosti on our show, and he is a cadaver dog specialist. And he told me, Dave, you know how many cases I believe these killers have done this before. And what they'll do is when they find like John Wayne Gacy, they find his house in Des Plaines. They find all the bodies there. That's enough for them. They wrap up the case. That's the end of the story. He said, I'll bet you dollars to donuts. If we went to the house he lived in prior to that and we did a sweep of the cadaver dog, we're going to find some bodies. You know, would the current residents of the home be willing to allow a luminescence test or, you know, a backyard cadaver dog sniffing something? Because if they want the case closed, they'd like answers. They're obviously not to be looked at because they didn't live there at the time. But would that be a possibility? Has that ever been approached?
I don't know that they've done that, but I do know there have been other things, like when the search was done with the cadaver dogs in that farm, they had a voluntary thing that people were more than willing to let them come in and do it. So it wouldn't surprise me. And the only reason we know about the cadaver search is because we were part of it. Again, if they're doing that sort of thing, we're certainly not in the loop on that.
Well, I don't know, you know, for what it's worth for you, we're friends with Sergeant Dosti. He has connections, although his dog, which was an amazing dog, Buster, died a few years ago. He knows others that are experts in the field that do this work and are willing to investigate. So if you know,
that's good to know.
I mean,
I think it takes a village. I really believe that we need people and all their talents wherever they are. If they have something, if he wants to offer it up to the Mason City Police, you know, again, they work a lot with the FBI and others, and that, you know, they say they have tools. I've asked them, in fact, at one point I asked them if they'd be willing to bring in the Viaduct Society or some other group to look at it, and they don't seem at this point to want to go outside. But, you know, maybe at some point if they, I don't know if they have like some cadaver dog teams ready to jump in if they need them, but it wouldn't hurt for him to write a letter and offer his services.
Would we need, you took it upon yourself with the work you were doing to investigate Tony Jackson's possible connections to this crime and do cadaver dogs. If would we need the authority of the local law to bring in our own team to investigate? Isn't that what private investigators are allowed to do as long as they don't interfere, meaning they're not out there trying to interfere in the current ongoing production? What would keep us from bringing somebody in or hiring somebody to do a sweep of that duplex and that property to see if there's anything there?
You know, all I can speak to in terms of our experience is we did actually work with law enforcement. They were there on the scene. So the local people, the captain at the time is now retired. He came to the scene. Law enforcement from that county came because these people, they want to make sure they're working with law enforcement. They wouldn't just do it with us going off to check a farm. They wanted to make sure that their protocol is to make sure they're working, cooperating with law enforcement. So that was how they did it.
You're out that way. I will try to connect you with Sergeant Dosti. He's retired.
Where is he now?
He's in
California. Is he in
California? Yes.
We're in California.
You know, I don't remember off the top of my head, but I will get to you.
I'd love to talk to anybody just to get educated, and I appreciate any tools that are out there.
And he'll be the first to tell you, as he's told us on our show in the past, that some cadaver dog specialists are not that great. And what they do, they have to do this tracking circle where the dog first marks may just be where the blood pooled. And if there's any up or downhill, if the body has decayed in a different location and weather wise, it's drawn down some of the decay, it may have pooled down here, but that's not where the body is. That's not where the juxta of it is.
And the body could have been there in this case. What if there'd been a body there and it was moved? You know, I
mean,
it can still pick up this. What I found pretty impressive after we did that, we went to Kansas where one of the cadaver dogs handlers were. We watched them. They did a training, and we did a story on that showing how it works. And it's fascinating. If you didn't believe in it ahead of time, when you watch what he did, it was really an amazing tool.
Well, and they even brought Sergeant Dosti, I believe, I think it was two or three years ago, while his dog was still alive, they brought him overseas to look for a couple of, I believe it was paratroopers from World War II.
Oh, really?
That the dog was able to find. The dogs, it's remarkable how when you have a really good dog, they can find unbelievable information.
Oh, they're huge. And they can do it in water. I mean, there's all kinds of things.
Yes.
It's an amazing, amazing tool.
It tells you there's definitely
a site that you think needs to be checked.
But reinvestigating that duplex in that home may be something, you know, I mean, in the cursory examination, maybe he did pass muster and, you know, that's that. But now that things are starting to show up, it'd be interesting to reexamine those locations. And now that he knows that there's been a warrant, and now that he knows people are sniffing around the old digs, will that bring him to do something stupid or bring him out to finally, you know, give the answer and you know, come forward? It's intriguing. We'll talk off air. We'll try to connect. I know we're going to be talking here soon on the Tom Bernard Show as well, regarding the Weepy Voice Killer. So we'll discuss more, but, yeah, I you know, we'd love to see an answer come to this story and to this crime as a fellow broadcaster. And we just love to see that, you know, all of these crimes get solved eventually, but it would be nice to bring Jody home.
Bring her home. And we do relate more. She is one of ours.
Right.
And my daughter was a morning producer at a station out in California. And I thought every day she went in to work at, you know, working at 2 o'clock in the morning, could there be somebody waiting for my daughter coming out? She was not on the air, but I think we do relate. And that's why we could use all the people, resources we have, do it on our, what we can to contribute and help bring her home.
Exactly. Caroline, thank you so much for spending some time with us this evening and allowing our listeners a little bit more scope into this case that a lot of them might not even have known about, because unfortunately it has been 23 years and people that don't live in the area may not even be aware of that story. But again, you don't know.
I would
know.
Ask them to go to our site. We have Josh Benson, who started it 15 years ago. He has stories he did 15 years ago, and he has been covering it. We have it's a pretty good archive if you want to get up to speed on things, and it's there. We put stories we come across, we park there, put it out there, and just hope that maybe someday whoever's doing it maybe come into our site.
Let me ask you this.
Somebody who's, they know, come into our site.
In closing, as an investigative journalist yourself, have you ever come across somebody during this that in your, and I'm not asking for a name, but I mean, has there ever been somebody that you look at that you think, I really think somebody needs to look into this person and they never have been looked into?
I can't say that I have. The ones that I looked at initially, because as I mentioned, the serial rapist, I thought he needed to be looked at given his background, given what we knew he's capable of. I think they've looked at Van Cise from day one and really haven't looked away from him very often. But at this point, I can't think of anybody who's come to our attention and I've heard about who's not been looked at. But there could be none of the above, someone we don't know.
Well, Caroline, thank you again. And findjody.com, that's the website to take a look at. And we encourage anybody out there, reach out to the findjody.com website. If you feel more secure, email me, dave@darknessradio.com. We'll pass on the bulk of the information and not your private information. If you're willing to answer that question of where Jody is, that's what we'll do on our side. We'll be in touch with you, Caroline. I'll put you in touch with Sergeant Dosti and see if we can't get some answers and maybe shake a couple of new bushes and see if something doesn't come out.
Well, I'm very grateful that you're doing this, because you don't know who might be tuning in, who could be that one person, that one call that we need to bring Jody home.
I agree. And that's it. And please, folks, you know, we do a lot of these shows and they make you sit back and they make you think. And just please do us a favor until next week. Just hold that person you love a little closer. Tell them you love them one more time. Don't hesitate. Don't wait for the right time to do or say things the right way, because you just never know when that may be the last time you ever had a chance to share those moments. We'll be back again with you next week here on the best in True Crime Talk Radio. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader, and this is True Crime Tuesday.